This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. The Supreme Court in the middle of two cases that could dramatically reshape the internet as we know it. The big issue, how responsible are social media platforms for the content on them and how that content drives people's behavior? Now, the court heard the associated cases this week in long arguments, and Boston Globe technology writer Hiawatha Bray here in Studio 2 has been watching what's going on. Welcome back, Hiawatha.
Oh, glad to be here. I wasn't watching because they don't have cameras, but they do broadcast the audio live, which is really great.
So you were listening.
I was listening, yes. And these were, you know, the typical Supreme Court cases argued for roughly an hour. Both of these cases, there are two separate cases. One was heard on Tuesday, one was heard on Wednesday, and each session lasted over 2.5 hours.
Gnarly
they
stuff.
Just went on and on and on about it, because what's at stake is extremely important. The first case is the really hot button one. It's called Gonzalez versus Google. It's filed by the family of a person who was killed in a 2015 terrorist attack.
In Paris,
that's right. Like about 100-some people got killed in this thing. And they are holding Google's YouTube. You know, as you know, it's Alphabet. Alphabet owns Google, and it also owns YouTube. And they were suing because they say that YouTube had videos on board that radicalized these attackers. But there's a very important additional point that they're making. They are arguing that because YouTube uses algorithms that pick and choose what people will see next, that gives them special responsibility that overrides the protection that they're supposed to be getting from the internet's most famous law, the 26 words, as it is known. And that is Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act. And then you have to dive down the rabbit. Do you want me to explain what that is?
So let me do that part.
Please,
so basically,
ahead.
It basically says this is a dumb platform, meaning it's the platform, but people are responsible themselves for what they put on that platform, just like the telephone's not responsible for what I say into
basically,
it.
That's the general idea. Is the telephone company responsible if you are using it to plan a crime? No. Is the internet or a particular internet company responsible if you use it to post all kinds of awful things? No.
Except now this curation thing that you're talking
about. That's the sudden argument that's come up here. They claim that back when this law was written,
1996,
when you put stuff on the internet, it was just there, and you would go look for it, and you'd find it, and you'd see it. If you wanted to look, or if you didn't want to look, it was up to you. Today, almost all of these social media and advertising and shopping sites, everything, wherever you go, when you log on, it tries to figure out what to show you next. It has carefully studied everything they can find out about you, and they want to make money off you. So they're saying, oh, we need to keep them here. Let's show them another video like this. Let's show them another video like this. And so if you're looking at videos showing people blowing stuff up, it'll say, oh, let's get the next video of somebody blowing stuff up.
So the question is this intentionality in both these cases then, right?
Mm-hmm.
All right. So what? Okay, well, two things.
Right.
One, I'm curious what you heard from the justices. I'm a little extra intrigued by Ketanji Brown Jackson because she's the newest justice here.
Right.
What did you hear about sort of what the kinds of questions they were asking and where they seemed to be going with
it? Well, I thought it was a fascinating set of arguments, and Ketanji Brown Jackson was very sharp. I think the sharpest questions came from her, Elena Kagan, Sam Alito. They were all just asking really, really sharp questions. Clarence Thomas was a surprise because he has publicly criticized Section 230 and said, you know, we may need to take another look at this. But in the oral arguments, he seemed to be stepping back from that. It was like he had studied this matter and started to go, hey, I don't know about this.
Interesting.
Like, for example, he was saying, you know, if you have an algorithm that is neutral, it isn't passing judgment on the nature of what you're looking at. It's simply saying, I'm going to show you more of what you want. I'm going to show you more of what you want. How does that amount to aiding and abetting terrorism? And
so,
that was one of the questions that he asked. And it makes it sound like he has really thought about this and begun to think, gee, you know, just knocking down Section 230 could be a real problem.
So, Hiawatha, we've heard about Section 230 from you before. There was also a Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court case about it where, well, it got invoked in a case about 2 years ago with a car platform at Logan Airport, right? So it's all over the place.
Right.
Do you have a sense, two things? One, is there some sense that it would be so destabilizing to change this that the bar is going to be very high to rule for plaintiffs who say, you know, we got to change how we think about this.
Well, I think that's pretty much the way the court sounded. Like,
okay,
if they're trying to figure out if there's any change they could make to it that wouldn't massively destabilize the way the internet works. For example, you know, we actually had, what was it? Justice Amy Coney Barrett raised a great point. She said, okay, if Section 230 is gone, suppose I retweet something on the internet. I'm a Twitter user and I retweet a terrorist message. Am I possibly legally liable for having retweeted something that was terrorism? And I doubt anybody would take it that far, but strictly speaking, she had a point. They're very concerned about this. Would these companies now face a tidal wave of lawsuits over any outrageous or ridiculous thing that somebody posts on their sites? And
make them not post stuff.
Exactly. A number of things could happen. One of the most interesting is that they might, for example, see if they could find some way to do it without using algorithms that would promote this kind of content. But if you don't use algorithms to promote content, people are going to leave because, like it or not, I actually go to Facebook sometimes because I want to see what they're going to show me next. Lots of us do that. I don't use TikTok because I'm worried about China, you know?
We're going to get to China and the balloons in just a minute.
Yeah, but Facebook has a lesser version of the same thing called Reels, and I find myself looking at it all the time. Half of it is stolen from TikTok, by the way. But the point is, I like having these things constantly showing me new stuff. So do we want to lose that?
In the world of law and tech, Hiawatha is, and we're talking with Hiawatha Bray from the Boston Globe here about these two Supreme Court cases this week.
Right.
Is there anything that's happened in the last few years to codify the opposite, to protect social media platforms and their right to, I mean, they picked this method. Algorithms right. didn't used to exist. Now it does. They chose to do it because it worked for them for their business model.
Right, exactly.
Is there anything in the law to protect it, or is this just fully an open question?
Well, it's an open question. I mean, that's the point. They just started doing things this way. However, the lawyer for Google, who was really sharp, by the way, she was saying, look, this is a myth that algorithms have not been used all along. They said, well, algorithms weren't in use back in 1996. Yes, of course algorithms have been in use. Very much simpler, cruder algorithms. But basically, an algorithm is not necessary. We hear the word, we think, fancy computer program. An algorithm is simply a process for doing things in a certain way. And always, for as long as the internet's been around, there have been certain rules for how you're going to show certain things to certain people. It's just today they're much more sophisticated. She talked about how Google search, if you say that Google search isn't protected because it uses algorithms to decide what people are going to see, there goes Google search, because everything they do on Google search, never mind YouTube, is decided by algorithms about what you see. If you do a search...
ChatGPT even more so, right? ChatGPT, the new AI stuff.
I don't know about that one. I mean, with I haven't thought about how ChatGPT would be affected by that. How would that work? You could be right. That's a fair question. But what I was thinking is, if you use Google and I use Google, we are liable to see different things because Google knows you, Google knows me. When I search for one thing, you search for the same thing, we might get entirely different answers.
I'm laughing because I want to say, like, no one knows me.
There you go.
Google
you
doesn't know me.
You think no one knows you, but every move you make is being tracked. And there are good reasons to worry about that.
Yeah.
But if that causes these guys to be legally liable, and the members of the court talked about this, if Section 230 is dropped, how do they protect themselves from constant lawsuits? And I think it was the attorney for the Gonzalez family said, oh, well, most of these cases, they'd win anyway because there's no reason for them. Well, I'm not sure I understood that argument, because their whole point is they want to be able to sue like YouTube for having assisted and helped finance terrorism, because some of these videos are monetized. So in a sense, they're sending these people money. And the court was actually having this interesting argument about whether or not, that's one of the things Clarence Thomas was saying, even if you didn't have Section 230, would these guys actually have gone far enough to have done something that could make them subject to anti-terrorism law?
Right.
And they were arguing, they don't know. And it's possible that some courts would say yes, some courts would say no. You see the problem here.
So the outcome's just not certain.
It's a zoo.
So when the court will let us know next June, right?
By next June anyway. We don't know when they're going to rule on this. You never know. But it is a hugely consequential case for the future of the internet, and nobody's really sure what's going to happen. But based on the noises that I heard coming from that courtroom, it's not going to be some radical, let's tear it all down thing. They are very aware of how sensitive this is.
All right. Do you have time for us to shift gears for just a minute?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Because I want to look to the skies.
Ah.
Bro, what'd you see?
Something above the clouds.
That's big.
How big?
Big.
I had to, because this whole thing reminds me of Kiki Palmer and Daniel Kaluuya, 2022, Nope. In my mind, by the way, brilliant movie. I know you haven't seen it, so I won't give you any spoilers, but looking up to the sky, I just have to ask you, because with what's been going on, the Chinese spy balloon that was shot down on the East Coast after traveling across the country, you know, the subsequent shooting down of other things that the President Biden administration is now saying probably weren't a threat, but who could be sure, so let's shoot them down. You looked to the skies.
Yeah.
And you found out what's actually up there.
Lots and lots of balloons.
Yeah, so surprising.
No, well, yeah, 67,000 alone by the U.S. National Weather Service alone every year.
67,000
balloons. And that doesn't count all the scientific and the research and the hobbyists and the academic people who are launching balloons into the sky. It's very common. I'm sure you heard the story. One hobbyist group in Illinois thinks that one of the balloons they got shot down was one of theirs. Total price, $12.
For shooting it down, though.
No, not for shooting it down. Because there are all kinds of reasons to use balloons. We all think, well, satellites are great. But it turns out, of course, that satellites, good as they are, have two disadvantages. First, no matter how good the cameras are, they're up a couple of hundred miles. They aren't going to take the world's sharpest pictures. If you could be at 60,000 feet, a relatively cheap camera can take really great pictures from that altitude.
And a balloon can do that.
The second reason, though, is the balloon can stick around for a while. Satellites zipping overhead at 17,000 miles an hour. The balloon, you can park
can
balloons.
Hover.
That's right. There's a company in South Dakota. They've got a contract with the U.S. Forest Service. They're going to be putting balloons up over the California forests next summer to monitor for wildfires. They can keep them up for weeks. And they can just take pictures. They can detect, they could have infrared cameras to detect heat. They can do all that stuff. Balloons as a surveillance tool are actually very, very beneficial.
And there are tens of thousands of them, and their technology, I mean, this was the big thing for me, Hiawatha. Uh-huh. Not obsolete. Actually still really valuable.
Very valuable.
The hobby thing, yeah. But the research thing and understanding the weather, et cetera, this is an advanced, even today, technology.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, because of what you can hang underneath the balloon, plus the fact that we now know so much about wind patterns and air patterns that you can actually use the knowledge to maneuver the balloon. You know, the way they steer some of these balloons is they don't have any kind of power on it. What they do is they calculate what the wind is going to be at a certain altitude, and they can actually make it rise or fall in midair. They can pump more helium into it or let helium out and make it go up to where the air is blowing in the direction they want to move it or down into a different direction, and they can just move it around in the sky and keep it up for weeks at a time.
So
it's extremely
anywhere.
Useful. Oh, no, we're going to be using balloons for a long time to come.
I just had to hear you talk about balloons.
Oh, yeah, isn't it great?
That's Boston Globe technology writer Hiawatha Bray. Thanks.
Been fun.